Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Good morning. Glad to have you with us. We're going to have a very special show today. I have three very interesting guests. It's going to be interesting for you as well as fun for me. I'm going to be with Francis Rose, who does the in-depth afternoon drive show here on WFED, and he's sitting across from me even as we speak. We're going to talk for a little bit, and then we're going to both go and switch into talking with the Federal Times folks.
Okay.
Steve Watkins, who is the editor of the Federal Times, Sean Riley, who is a senior writer, and we've got so much to talk about this week and today from the retiree COLA, which, by the way, if you have not heard, it is 3.6%. That will be effective in December, and it will first show up in checks or deposits made to the retirees, people who get Social Security and people who get military retired pay. They will get a 3.6% increase in their January checks, their January payments. And this is a big deal because the retirees have not had a COLA since 2009, mm-hmm. when they got a 5.8%. And as we all know, health insurance premiums went up about 7.5% last year on average, and they're going to go up about 3.8% this year on average. So what's your take on that, Francis?
Well, the COLA does not surprise me because as we've been following all of the indicators throughout the year, you and I have been talking about this on my show, in the afternoon quite a bit. So that's not a big surprise. I think what surprised me was just the whole concept of the fact that there doesn't seem to be, I have not seen any indication as far as some of the recommendations to the super committee that anything happened to slow down or stop the cost of living adjustments, especially to federal employees, but overall throughout the entire population. I mean, if you think about how much we pay out as a country in Social Security benefits, and again, cutting it, slicing it up a little bit just for federal employees, there's potential savings there. Painful, yes, for the people who are receiving those payments, but potential savings yet. And I haven't seen that on anybody's recommendations so far. There is a story on Politico today about how the super committee is being flooded with recommendations, and I think that's a fair word. We've seen any number of letters from members of Congress, chairs of committees, or chairs of caucuses, ranking members of committees, and so on, with recommendations. A lot of those involve the pay and benefits package to federal employees, but I haven't seen the COLA listed anywhere.
The COLA, the National Active and Retired Federal Employees, were on the show some weeks back, and Dan Adcock mentioned at the time that there had been a previous proposal. I think it was from the Bowles,
the Simpson-Bowles
Commission, right, that was appointed or set up by President Obama. And I think they made a recommendation for some changes in the way the COLA is figured.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been other groups as well. The Blair House Group, headed by Vice President Biden, made some recommendations. The Obama administration itself made a couple of recommendations that surprised people, including higher contributions for people who were under both the CSRS and the FERS retirement systems.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was talk of one more year delay in giving people a pay raise. But the thing they were talking about, and we can get into this with Steve Watkins and Sean Riley from the Federal Times, there was talk of, and nobody had seen it in writing, but there was talk of going to something called the chained CPI.
Mm-hmm.
And what that would do is the people who don't like it say it's a way to undercut retirees and to cheat them, to give them less money than they deserve.
Mm-hmm.
People who think this is a good idea say that the current CPI overstates the cost of living because it has a constant market basket. And they say it doesn't account for the fact or allow for the fact that when times are tough, people go, as somebody pointed out, from steak to hamburger,
mm-hmm.
from filet mignon to chicken,
right?
And but the problem with that is if you keep adjusting it downward like that, you're going to get consistently smaller raises each and every year than you would under the regular CPI system. The interesting thing, and we can talk to this with Sean and Steve, is how, to as far as I know, nothing is leaking out of this super committee. People are afraid, for instance, if federal employee issues were leaking, you'd know where the leak came from. It would be from a Congressman Van Halen and probably Senator Patty Murray of Washington. They are friends of Fed's,
mm-hmm.
and they're on that commission. So they've got to know that if there is a leak, it's going to be traced right back to them, and they would be, I don't know what punishing powers the committee has.
Horsewhipped, I think.
Horsewhipped and dragged through the streets.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, this is a way to keep the lid on it, to you know what's happening. As you said, there have been hundreds, probably thousands of recommendations to these people. And I think the deadline for doing that was last Friday. We're now finding out and catching up with what some of those recommendations are. But as you can imagine, they cover the waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that some people are speculating on, and I must say, as far as I know, the experts here, if that includes us, it's all guesswork. Everybody is guessing. Nobody knows what's going to happen. And many people who have looked at this before, when you look at the Simpson-Bowles Commission, when you look at the Biden-Blair House group, when you look at the Ryan GOP group, and you look at others, blue ribbon mm-hmm. groups that have come to this, what they finally did in the end was nothing.
That's
right.
They
made recommendations. They either weren't approved by the group as a whole, or the Congress didn't deal with them. And there is a distinct possibility that after the dust is settled on this super commission, this bipartisan Senate House group, that they will either not make any recommendations, won't be able to come to an agreement, or if they do, that the Congress, although it's more or less pledged to give it an up or down vote, simply won't do it. And in that case, some people say that would be good for feds as federal workers, good for retirees, but it would not be good for them as citizens, because that would then trigger a mandatory, I think, $1.3 trillion cuts, half of which would be in the Defense Department.
Yeah. The whole super committee dynamic has fascinated me, because I've seen any number of pieces. The latest was in the New York Times, and talking about this argument between transparency and secrecy. You and I talked on my show a couple of weeks ago about the idea that in Washington, your experience and in the time that you've been here and mine, the much shorter time that I've been following this stuff, is that when you don't hear anything, that seems to be when we get closest to a deal. That seems to be right around the corner. This is kind of turning that on its ear, because theoretically, I find it hard to believe that we would hear from the super committee in, say, the next week. I would imagine they're going to use every day and every hour and every minute of negotiating time they have to reach a deal. And they have until November 18th. So by my math, that's about, what, 3 weeks or so.
Yeah. And you're right. I think the past is apparently no longer prologue mm-hmm. to the future.
Yeah.
Everything that we've known, from investing to the real estate market, seems to have been turned on its head. And in the past, the way to and President Lyndon Johnson was famous for this. If you have a problem, you appoint a blue ribbon commission. They study it to death, and it sort of goes away and dies on its own. The only time that I can recall, and I'm sure there have been others, but, you know, you had several Hoover commissions mm-hmm. that looked at the government. Very little happened in that. You had various kinds of reform. But the only one that I can recall working the way it was supposed to work was the BRAC Commission, the Base Realignment and Closure Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, they said, okay, we're going to make some hard choices here. We're going to cut bases in every congressional district. We're going to cut back, and it's either going to be an up or down vote on this. And that seemed to work, even though it's still being implemented. But with this new super commission, we just don't know. So mm-hmm. we can talk about that when we come back after a break.
Sounds
here
great.
On WFED Federal News Radio.
Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on Federal News Radio at 10 a.m. Please join me this week for my special guest and partner, John Dedon, trusts and estates expert at Odin, Feldman & Pittleman. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by the full-service law firm of Odin, Feldman & Pittleman, located in Fairfax and serving the entire D.C. metro area. If you'd like to know more about us, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
Government technology professionals should prepare to attend GovCom 2011, the new trade show featuring government audio-visual communication solutions at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center, November 1st and 2nd, featuring nearly 100 leading manufacturers and solutions providers showcasing the latest in audio, video, conferencing, collaboration, control systems, digital signage, and visual display technologies. GovCom will help government agencies and the military boost collaboration, enhance security, improve reliability, and cut costs. GovCom is your opportunity to see cutting-edge communications products, network with fellow technology professionals, and get valuable training from leading experts in government and industry. For more information and your free exhibits pass, visit GovCom with 2 M's show.org and use the code FED. That's govcomshow.org. GovCom is brought to you by Infocom International, the association representing the audiovisual industry.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by EADS North America.
A change has come for the Marines. They're now being allowed to wear bracelets commemorating friends killed in action, a policy change that caused some friction. At issue, killed-in-action bracelets. Usually, they're thin, rubber or metal bands with the names of the fallen in Afghanistan, Iraq, or some other combat zone on them. Normally, uniform regulations prevent them from wearing them. Commandant General James Amos said the issue has been discussed and settled. I'm J.J. Green.
Every day, EADS North America supports Homeland Security and Defense missions here at home and around the globe. Over land and water, in our ports and at our points of entry, EADS North America provides critical solutions and systems that protect our borders and coastlines. Our vigilance is unwavering. Our commitment is steadfast. EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
AT&T's commitment is clear. That's why we're announcing that with the planned merger with T-Mobile, AT&T will begin bringing 5,000 jobs to America from overseas. We will invest $8 billion more and deploy the next generation of wireless broadband to nearly everyone in America. This investment will create as many as 96,000 American jobs. We're ready to invest in America. AT&T.
Since 1886, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, D.C. has been helping children in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Now they are visited by over 3,000 children every day. The club teaches character and leadership development and arts education. No child is turned away for being unable to pay the $25 fee, and the club needs your help to make this happen. Give a gift online at bgcgw.org. The life you lift up today will be the life that brings a better world tomorrow. This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio.
Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey, and I'm joined today by Francis Rose, who does the afternoon drive here on our station, and Steve Watkins from the Federal Times is with us, the editor of the Federal Times. Steve, are you there?
Good to be with you.
Great. Well, we got a threesome going here today. You know, I'm reminded of John Kennedy when he was hosting a group of Nobel laureates for a dinner one time at the White House, and he said, "This is the greatest collection of brain power that's been assembled in this room since Thomas Jefferson dined alone." So it just goes to show that with the three of us here, we're going to cover the waterfront. You guys have been following the super committee very closely, I know, and are you finding out anything?
Well, we're finding out that they're going to be completely swamped with all sorts of options to look at. But a lot of them, to be frank, are not new. In fact, I haven't really seen anything that so far that's being recommended that's a new idea. But we have seen that everyone's kind of throwing everything in the kitchen sink at them. And, of course, they're being asked to look at all the Simpson-Bowles Deficit Commission recommendations as well. So they've got their hands full in terms of the number of things to look at, and they're all over the board. Of course, you know, there's dozens that affect our audience, your audience, federal workers, paying benefits, but also federal operations and resource management and that sort of thing that's going to affect them at their jobs. But in terms of paying benefits, I think a lot of the ideas that are being recommended and sent to them and all the congressional committees sent their recommendations to the super committee last week on Friday. So they're sifting through those now. And some are quite draconian and We've talked about a lot of them in the past because they've come up kind of in other avenues, but you know, it remains to be seen what they're going to end up doing, and for that matter, if they're even going to come to some sort of consensus agreement.
Steve, it's Francis. It's good to talk to you. The thing that I found most interesting, I wonder what you think, is a lot of the recommendations are being made to the super committee, as you said, are not new, but some of them are codified for the first time, where somebody actually formally attaches his or her name to them, the high three to high five conversion, and reducing some of the payments into FERS and eliminating FERS for new people and so on. Any of those seem to you to have any more possibility of traction than others?
I don't think so. You mean because now people are putting their names to them?
Yeah, just because somebody's finally standing up and saying, I'm willing to attach my name to this, I wonder if that gives any of these any more credence than others.
Well, I think some probably now have the, you know, the stamp of the party on them that perhaps in the past they didn't. So, you know, I think, for instance, eliminating the FERS defined pension benefit, obviously that's probably a scary notion for all of our audiences, and that would affect all new federal employees. And that was recommended by Darrell Issa, the head of the House Government Oversight and Reform Committee. That is a proposal that we've seen in the past. Senator Coburn is brought that up, and Issa, we've been aware that he's kind of been looking at that, as well as other ideas such as stopping the within grade step increases along with the pay raises. So I don't think any of it, to be honest, is going to come as a surprise to anybody. You know, it has their name on it, and now it's being formally proposed as a recommendation, but I don't necessarily think that makes it any stronger as an option for people to think about. And I think, given that, you know, whatever the committee comes up with, the super committee, it's going to have to get agreement from both sides, Democrats and Republicans. Those kinds of proposals that strike me as pretty far out on the margins, and I would have a hard time imagining that they would get approval from both sides of the aisle.
See, when you talk about the concept of eliminating a defined benefit, this means that for people hired in future in the government, and they would be hired under the FERS retirement system, that the government would give them the thrift savings plan, the 401k plan. They'd pay into Social Security, but there would be no civil service benefit whatsoever from the government.
Correct. Yeah. And what ISA has talked about is replacing it with a defined contribution benefit. Now, there's no detail there that gives any further sense of what he might have in mind. Sounds to me like the TSP. You know, maybe they might expand the TSP benefit portion.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. Is that what it sounds like to me? How is it different, if at all?
Yeah. And that's essentially what the TSP is, and that's what, you know, most non-feds know as a 401k. So perhaps that's what he has in mind, but, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
And a big difference, too, because if it's a defined benefit, then the government is promising you a certain return, and after a certain number of years, based on your salary, you will get this, mm-hmm. and it will be indexed at least in whole or part to inflation. But a defined benefit is very different from a defined contribution, right?
Oh, certainly, yeah. Because a defined contribution, as everyone knows, either from their 401k or their TSP, you know, they know what they're putting into it, but at the end of the day, they really don't know what they're going to end up having when they retire, and what they can count on in terms of withdrawals, because obviously the stock market fluctuates, the bond market, and so forth, so. That's a much more worrisome prospect, I think, for feds.
Maybe it is more worrisome, but I'm not sure it needs to be. I mean, when we go back and look at the returns in the thrift savings plan over the past 15 to 20, and if you even want to go back 25 or 30 years, What's the average service in the federal government now? Either one, anybody know?
You know,
I mean, I'm going to guess. If I had to guess, it was in the 20 to 25 year range. But
right now, I mean, how long? How much people? I think they have about 18 years.
Okay.
Right now.
So if you look at the past 18 year performance of the Thrift Savings Plan, yes, the last 5 years or so have been a little rough, but the overall the past 18 have been pretty good. And if you have been in the TSP and been in the equity funds and not been playing it too conservative, you actually wind up with a better rate of return than you do with the part of the money that went into the pension plan and the defined benefit. So it is, I certainly understand the scariness because you don't know exactly what the number's going to be, but you wind up with a better number.
Well, you know, I think given the nature of government workers, and maybe they're different from, you know, there have been theories that they are less entrepreneurial than people in the private sector because they go for security. And you've seen that with the Thrift Savings Plan, a huge shift into the G Fund, mm-hmm. even though it's paying next to nothing, but it's paying something. And I think this idea of even if you show people that over historically the stock market has done well, they're looking at this year and last year and whatnot.
Well, but it's fair then, I think, in that context, Mike, to say that folks that have less retirement security than they would like have it because of their own decisions and because of their unwillingness to look at the facts that are presented to them and analyze those facts in a logical way.
Yeah,
that's not anybody else's fault.
It would be interesting to ask people, and Steve, jump in on this, if you gave them a choice to say, do you want a defined benefit or do you want a thrift savings plan where you could put 15% in, and we would put in another, the government would put in 7 to see how that would go. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it'd be overwhelmingly in favor of the defined benefit, that is. And for that reason, you know, I think, yes, everyone is flocking to the G Fund now, but I think there's a couple big factors behind that. One is that most feds are within reach of retirement if they're not already eligible. So really they're looking for a place where they know they can have a stable place, shelter in the storm kind of thing until, you know, things clear up and people have a better idea of where the better investments are. But and that's the other thing, is that I think the financial markets today are just so unpredictable and volatile that that's the attraction of the G Fund. But their feds are right on the cusp of retiring. They already are retiring. I think we're going to see that in much bigger numbers in the next couple of years. So the G Fund really is kind of the only place in town for people to put their money and expect that it's not going to disappear.
See, we want to take a short break here, but I want to ask you something about the law of unintended consequences when we come back here on WFED 1500 AM.
Federal friends, it's the Geico Gecko, and I've got good news for you. I might even say it's some of the best news ever. Okay, well, definitely in the top three. The big news, Geico offers discounts for most federal employees GS7 or above, which is no doubt a lot of you out there. So you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, all with a company that began over 70 years ago with the sole purpose of serving government employees like yourself. Yeah, that's right, Geico, the Government Employees Insurance Company. And today, well, we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. And did you know about Geico's 97% customer satisfaction rate? Well, saving money tends to make people rather happy, I think. So congrats again to those federal employees GS7 or above. Welcome to the Savings Club. Mike?
Got it. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. The Gecko's right. Discounts are available for most federal employees GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The Army is preparing to publish a new set of standards that will dictate what technology is allowed to operate on its network. Officials say the integrated network baseline will let the service do a better job of keeping up with the technology cycle by adopting common, open standards without dictating precisely what technologies they'll allow. The Army also plans to require any vendors who want to participate in its huge network integration evaluation to comply with the baseline.
General Dynamics Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology, information technology, and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com. Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit. Presented by NITP has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
Hi, everybody. It's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
Join us next Sunday, October 23rd. We're getting mad in studio with Mad Fox Brewery, and it's going to be a little sweet. We're talking honey with founding farmers.
And Johnny Moe, the musical chef, will be in. I don't know what that means. That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday and every Sunday live right here on 1500 and 820 a.m.
We live in uncertain times. More than ever, federal agencies rely on TASC to accomplish the most important missions and protect America's way of life. Few in the world can do what the experts at TASC do. Trusted partners, honest counselors, TASC's highly specialized problem solvers use rare knowledge and deep experience to provide advanced systems engineering, integration, and decision support services that the U.S. government depends on to keep the country safe and secure. TASC, working for you and the nation. TASC.com.
Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. I'm talking today with Francis Rose, who does his own show in the afternoons, In Depth, and also with Steve Watkins, editor of the Federal Times. We've been looking at the super committee, what it might or might not do, and we all admit, agree, coming from different directions, that this is all guesswork. Mm-hmm. We know what some of the recommendations they're getting, but we don't have any idea at all what they're considering. Would you say that's a fair statement, Steve?
What they're considering, I think pretty much all these options that we're talking about and many others that have been reported on, I think the real question is, are they going to have the will, political will on both sides to strike some sort of agreement? Obviously, the biggest agreement is the question over taxes, and if they can reach some sort of deal there, then I think other things will start falling into place. I would guess, to me, if the big question is, can they strike that deal? If they can, I would expect whatever they come up with to end up looking something like the Simpson-Bowles plan is what I would personally expect.
And I want to ask you something about one of my favorite subjects, the law of unintended consequences. And, we just had that wonderful Ken Burns series, Prohibition. And, they started in 1919, 1920. They're going to eliminate alcohol, and all our problems will be solved. Drunkenness will go away. There'll be no more traffic deaths. Men won't come home at night and beat their wives. And what it did was it jump-started organized crime as we know it in America. It gave them a reason for being and a way to make a lot of money with no tax revenue whatsoever to the government. When you get boxing gloves, you introduce boxing gloves to protect the hands, that enables prize fighters for the first time to go for the head and to punch each other in the head senseless, and now you have concussions and whatnot. The law of unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. You can think of it a thousand ways. And I was thinking, if this Congress, in its wisdom, decides to eliminate the defined benefit, that is, eliminate any civil service annuity for future federal hires, what is that likely to do to the federal government? Right now, people say retirement isn't all that important, but I think most people are pretty sophisticated, and they do check out the retirement system when they come in. And the federal retirement system is, I would think, a main draw to employment. But if you wipe that out, if it's just like any other company in the country, what could that do to the kind of people that come into government, and what could that do to continuity? I mean, people might come in punch their ticket, work 4 or 5 years, and then go on somewhere else rather than making a career of the government. What do you think about that?
Well, Senator Tom Coburn, Republican, who's been long critical of a lot of the federal pay and benefits that are in place, had an interesting quote, and we had it in one of our stories. But basically, he said we need to do away with careerism in the federal government, and or not incentivize careerism. Well, that's essentially what that does. You know, when you get rid of defined benefit pension, then, you know, I think that pokes a huge hole in the whole notion of, you know, are people going to make the federal government a career? It sounds like that's what some lawmakers are interested in doing. So, yes, I can definitely see that changing the nature of the federal workforce in the future.
I wonder how many terms Senator Coburn has served, if he's going to be a career senator.
He's on his second term now as a senator, and he's already said he's not running for re-election.
Okay, so right. 12 years, that's a good run.
And I think he did 12 years in the House.
Yeah, 3 or 4 terms.
Yeah,
So he could be listed as a career guy.
Yeah, Steve, you mentioned in your colleagues, at least Steve Riley, Sean Riley, and Steve Losey mentioned that the Lieberman-Collins proposal to the super committee has a recommendation that I think might be another unintended consequences thing here, and that is putting an end to what Mike has called over the years the FERS flu.
Yeah.
The ability for employees to use their sick leave toward their retirement. Anything that could happen as a result of that that maybe the senators haven't thought of yet?
I'm a little bit surprised to see that in their proposal. And given that, you know, it is being proposed by a bipartisan team, Lieberman and Collins, if you count independent as a partisan.
Right.
I think that does give it some heft, and as you say, they propose doing away with using unused sick leave and counting it towards retirement for FERS members, clearly that could you know, I would certainly expect to see a lot more sick leave come up should that happen, that feds will be absent from work more.
You know, I'm glad you guys brought that up, because when I saw that, I thought it was a misprint. I thought somebody who didn't understand the beat very well had gotten it exactly the opposite, and I didn't pay much attention to it. But
no.
It's for real.
No, Steve's colleagues say Lieberman and Collins also recommended a halt to allowing FERS participants to count unused sick leave toward their retirement. That would save $561 million over 10 years. And, Steve, I wonder what you think about this possibility. As I read the Lieberman-Collins letter, I thought, if we're trying to handicap this, maybe this is the one that we pay the most attention to. If we're going to make a scale of 1 to 10, and we're going to say that Bernie Sanders is a 1 and Jim DeMint is a 10, I think it would be fair to put Senator Lieberman and Senator Collins somewhere right around 5, maybe just to the left or right of 5. But I think that might give the super committee people cover to be able to say, well, these are coming from people who are right down the center, and we tried to go right down the center, and we might wind up seeing something that's not too terribly different than, at least among these issues, than what Senators Lieberman and Collins are proposing.
Yeah, I agree. I think it does give it some extra juice that it came from them, Lieberman and Collins. They've long been considered moderates, and the fact that, like I say, that, you know, they've long been kind of approached their jobs as head of the Senate Government Affairs and Homeland Security Committee. They've approached it in a very bipartisan way. They've always kind of looked for avenues of for partnership. They both signed on to this, and I think you're exactly right. I think it gives it a lot more currency in that discussion. The only detraction, I guess, from that is that the savings is fairly minimal. $561 million over 10 years is really peanuts compared to what the super committee is looking at in general. You know, they're talking trillions and hundreds of tens of billions.
So. Well, and that's fair, but if you add that to some of the other things that they're recommending, like the increase to FERS and the high three to high five transition, yes, it doesn't go to the billions that the super committee needs to hit. But it seems to me that when you have co-chairs, Senator Murray, who on my scale there is probably a 2, 3, 4, and Congressman Hensarling, who's probably a 7, 8, 9, they can come out side by side and say, yeah, we know we're at opposite ends of the spectrum, but we went to these items, and certainly a long list of others, not just these regarding federal employees.
You get a basket of enough of these proposals, and it adds up.
Yeah, that's
right.
The
other thing is, I think this in particular kind of goes towards a theme that we've seen not just from Republicans, but from even the Obama administration and moderate Democrats, and I would put Lieberman in that category, of basically trying to do away with those benefits that feds enjoy that really are fairly unique in the federal sector, federal community, and that kind of are divisive in terms of feds versus the private sector. No one else that I know of can apply unused sick leave towards their retirement. That's a pretty unique benefit for feds.
Steve, we need to take a short break here, but I want to ask you where we are in the FERS process when we get back here on WFED 1500 AM.
Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
Hey, Lucas.
Hello, Angie. You ready for dinner?
Yeah. Hey, is that a new radio for your ride?
Sure is. Went to Walmart for the Pioneer DEH-44HD with HD radio built in.
HD radio?
HD radio is digital broadcast radio. Digital sound, new channels, no subscription fees.
From Walmart?
Great values there. Only $120 for a Pioneer HD radio receiver.
Forget dinner. Let's get my car and head to Walmart.
HD radio. More radio, more value. Now in the car audio department at Walmart.
Where did you leave it? Where could it have possibly gone? It's frustrating because you used to have your motivation with you all the time, and now, ugh. That's okay. We'll help you find it. First, let's find your reason. You know, your reason. What's that thing that makes you want to live to an age where you can say whatever you want to whomever you want, and somehow it becomes charming? Next, find your thing. What is that healthy thing you actually love doing? There's got to be one, right? Finally, go find your partner. Who's the ping to your pong? The downward to your dog? Who'll keep your butt moving and vice versa? Find all of those things. We're pretty sure your motivation will magically appear. But if you're still having trouble finding it, try looking really, really hard in the mirror. We're Kaiser Permanente, and we're here to help you find your motivation to thrive. Visit kp.org/thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has an expansive and varied mission. What is Homeland Security's acquisition strategy? How is DHS enhancing its acquisition oversight? And what is DHS doing to better manage its resources and execute its overall mission? Join host Michael Keegan on the next Business of Government Hour as he explores these questions and so much more with Dr. Nick Nyack, Chief Procurement Officer of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security.
Welcome to Beltway Q&A, provided by EMC. Our guest is Dan Doherty, Vice President, EMC Federal. Dan, can one-size storage and backup solutions fit all mission needs?
No. Some requirements, like full-motion video, virtualization, backup and recovery, have specialized needs that are best met by simple purpose-built solutions.
So understanding the mission requirements is important to architecting the right solution.
Yes. EMC works hard to first understand the mission and then deliver solutions that are optimized, simple, and affordable.
Available on GSA schedule through government acquisitions.
It's the Geico Gecko with a little hello to all you federal employees. Now, in government, there are people on all points of the political spectrum, but there is one thing that everyone agrees on. Saving money is good. Which brings me to the big news. Geico offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. It don't matter if you're a Democrat or an aristocrat, left wing, right wing, or a chicken wing. If you're a federal employee, GS7 or above, you could be saving a lot of money on your car insurance by switching to GEICO. So no matter if you're blue or red or, in my case, green. If you're a federal employee, GS7 or above, contact GEICO and see how much you could save. Isn't that right, Mike?
Exactly right, my little green friend. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. And like the Gecko said, discounts are available for most federal employees, GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local GEICO office to see how much you could save.
Human Capital Management Federal is a highly anticipated training conference with over 300 delegates and key speakers, such as John Berry, Director of the Office of Personnel Management, John Sepulveda, Assistant Secretary for Human Resources and Administration at the Department of Veterans Affairs, and Michael Caine, Chief Human Capital Officer for the Department of Energy. The event is November 14th through 16th at the Sheraton National Hotel in Arlington, Virginia. Visit hcmfederal.com for more info and to register now. Mention code FNRHCMF to receive a 10% discount.
Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. I want to thank Steve Watkins, the editor of the Federal Times, for being with us and gave us a great rundown on what the super committee is looking at and maybe some of the outcomes and scenarios. Now we've got on the line Sean Riley, senior writer for the Federal Times. Sean, are you with us?
I'm here. Good morning.
Hey, and Francis Rose is opposite me in the studio here.
Good to talk to you, Sean.
Likewise.
Hey, Sean, so much going on, and I know you guys have been watching the Postal Service very carefully. Huge operation, 800,000 people, second largest federal agency. You have buyouts, you have early outs. I noticed today that the forever stamp is now not going to be it's going to go up a penny.
Nothing is forever.
Nothing is forever. And you've been covering the Postal Service. What's going on there? And the National Association of Letter Carriers, they hire this very expensive, I would assume, outfit, the Lazar Group, to come up with a way to save the Postal Service. What's going on there?
You got a lot of people going in a lot of different directions, I think. I think what the last week or so has brought out is the complete lack of any kind of consensus about where the postal, you know, what should be done about the Postal Service. I thought the letter carriers deciding to hire, you know, not only the czar, but also President Obama's former so-called car czar, Ron Blum, the guy who kind of oversaw the bailout of the auto industry 2 years ago, was interesting in that they are apparently union's goal is to come up with some sort of alternative strategy that, in their view, would capitalize on the Postal Service's strength, such as its, you know, huge delivery network, rather than cutting, which essentially is where the Postal Service is trying to go right now. As you know, they want to close or looking at closing about 3,700 post offices. They're planning to close more than 300 processing plants. Cut about 35,000 jobs associated with those plans. What the NLC is saying, you know, they essentially see this strategy as destroying the Postal Service. They want to come up with some sort of alternative to that that would essentially grow the Postal Service, understood them right. You know, how much this is going to cost them and exactly how it's going to be, you know, how Lazard and Blum are going to proceed is not clear at this point. Whether they'll come up with reports, you know, try and draft legislation for Congress to consider. But meanwhile, as we saw from the recommendations of the Supercommittee, you have Congressman Daryl Issa, the chair of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, saying that the Supercommittee really shouldn't deal with the Postal Service at all. Then you have in the Senate, the Senate counterpart to that committee, Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, saying, well, yeah, we need to do something, but not really spelling out what. You have the Obama administration coming up with some ideas that are probably non-starters, or at least a couple of them are. So it's, as I said, it's really not clear where you can find any common ground that could pass Congress and be signed by the White House.
I was once associated with a firm, and they brought in an expert to help save it. And what he did was just cut things. He cut off here, cut off there, and he did save a lot of money. But in the process, he ruined the company, as it were, made it impossible for it to deliver. No pun intended, like the Postal Service. Mm-hmm. And the argument was anybody can do that, but to have somebody come in and build it. And of course, the letter carriers, I guess one of their primary things is to save jobs and to save the 6-day week delivery.
Precisely. They're very opposed to that. And I think it was interesting for them trying, you know, whatever else you think about their decision to hire Lazard and Bloom, they are, I guess, trying to take a proactive step to coming up with another strategy rather than simply opposing what the Postal Service wants to do. But, of course, as you noted, you know, they are extremely opposed to cutting six-day delivery because, of course, that's going to cost some of their members their jobs.
Sean, I thought the whole conversation around the six-day delivery was fascinating because when it was floated from Congress, I expected, quite honestly, out amongst citizens, not necessarily in government, this wave of opposition, no, I expect my mail 6 days a week and Sunday's the only break and so on and so forth. If anything, I think we saw a wave the other direction, which was, yeah, I could probably live without that. You know what? I don't probably really need the mail the other 5 days. I could probably live with getting my mail 3 or 4 days a week. And I wonder if that scared the Postal Service unions quite a bit, because that wasn't just one place. I saw that in a number of commentaries at a number of different levels across the country.
Yeah, you raise an interesting point. I mean, the Postal Service Inspector General, for example, last year floated the idea of just going to every other day delivery, essentially 3 day a week delivery. And you have to, and what you say about public reaction going to 5 delivery is absolutely correct. I mean, there's not the opposition comes from politicians primarily, not from the public, at least not at this point. And certainly I think the unions have the letter carrier, both the National Association of Letter Carriers and the National Rural Letter Carriers Association have to be concerned that, once you go to 5 day, and there's no particular opposition, and I have a close relative, for example, who says that all she gets on Saturdays is junk mail anyway, so who cares? But that, once you do that, why not go to, 4 day, 4 day, 3 day, and simply keep consolidating.
That's the only reason I could think for the postal unions to choose 6 day delivery as where they were going to stake their flag, because they saw it as potentially a slippery slope.
Mm-hmm. And there, another argument that you hear from some members of Congress is that this would undermine, the Postal Service competitive advantage, or one competitive advantage they have. The fact they do deliver 6 days a week, whereas I understand it's a UPS and FedEx do not.
They do. You have to pay extra for that service, though.
Oh, thank you. Okay, but that's not the case with the Postal Service. It costs the same no matter what day of the week it's delivered. But that has to, once you to restate, once you begin curtailing deliveries, curtailing that to schedule, there's certainly no reason not to stop there if you're primarily focused on reducing costs.
I'll bet this is a generational thing too, the opposition or lack of it, because at one point in this country, and it's within our lifetimes, I believe there was twice a day delivery in the mail.
That's right. I mean, I don't know. They used to. That's absolutely right. I'm not sure when they moved away from that.
Maybe it was during the war, World War II. But I mean, it happened, and then we went away. Imagine getting an AM and a PM mail delivery.
I can't think of anybody, who would expect that anymore.
Right. But everything then, of course, had to go through the mail. This is before email and other forms of. Mm-hmm. But I just imagine, and also this has come up. People should know this is used to be what they called a Washington Monument cut, and mm-hmm. that is an agency faces a budget problem, or Congress actually cuts them. And in the case of the Interior Department, you say, okay, we'll shut down the Washington Monument for tourists even before the earthquake.
Yeah. The Government Accountability Office says that mail delivery was changed from twice a day to once a day in 1950.
Oh, okay.
It was after
thanks.
World War
so
II.
Many people could remember that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. And most people don't realize it ever happened. But the other thing was there was a sacred feeling about postmarks. Mm-hmm. And people, members of Congress, wanted it to be postmarked Brunswick, Maryland. They didn't mm-hmm. want it some north central Maryland facility. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a civic pride there. And I think that's probably gone away.
Pretty much,
a generational thing.
Actually, that is still there, at least in, I used to work in a very rural state. And I can tell you that when the issue of closing the local post office came up, one of the things that really stuck in people's craws was losing their local postmark. And I thought it was interesting, the Postal Service, in coming up with this, in studying these 3,700 or so post offices for closing, they've come up with this option called the village post office, essentially where you'd have a general store, for example, that would contract with the Postal Service and provide some Some services like selling stamps, taking in flat rate packages, that kind of thing. But the Postal Service is saying that if they do move to that in some communities, those communities would still be able to keep their postmarks. And I think that, and you know, particularly for these rural, these small towns that have been dwindling, and they see the post office as sort of an emblem of their survival, as well as their postmark, and holding on to them is, I think, a kind of important psychic symbol of endurance.
But there are a lot of places where that's gone away already. My parents live right outside of York, Pennsylvania, and about 5 years or so ago, the Postal Service, maybe longer now, the Postal Service closed the major distribution center in York and the major distribution center for Central, South Central PAs in Lancaster, and any mail I get from my parents now is postmarked Lancaster.
Really?
So not only is it not postmarked Dover, which is their local post office where they take everything that the carrier can't pick up, it's not even postmarked in the same county as they live in.
Wow.
So yeah, that part of it, I think, for a lot of folks is already gone.
Yeah, it goes to a central. Well, my kids handled that when we moved into Maryland. We were in one of the lesser desirable areas, but they referred to it as West Potomac, no matter what the zip code said. Yeah, well, it's funny, the emotion that this kind of thing evokes and how important it is. And you said they were going to... They wanted to shut down 37 post offices. 3,700.
Looking at, they're studying 3,700.
Okay, and
I think they probably will recommend for closing.
And those would be mom and pop, a lot of stores, rural stores, and things like that.
Yeah, well, I think these are actually post office operators. In some cases, they may be leasing the property, but I mean, these are actual post offices, as I understand it. And but these are ones that do very little, leased by the post office.
Yeah.
Postal Service is telling, do very little business, bring in very little revenue, essentially just don't have a business case to offer, about why they should continue.
And knowing what you know about the Postal Service, is could they expand services, I mean, start selling things at, like they do in some post offices in Europe? Do you think it can be saved?
It has to be saved, I think, at some point, or some semblance of the Postal Service has to be saved, just because it still carries tens of billions of pieces of mail a year. A lot of people still depend on it, business depend on it. In terms of getting into other lines of business, as in Europe, that certainly is something that's being explored. And as I understand it, this is before I began covering this issue, but say about 10, 11 years ago, the Postal Service did try to make some moves in, sort of expanding beyond, traditional snail mail, and ran into some opposition from the private sector, from private companies, essentially saying that, they were, even though they don't receive taxpayer money for operating expenses, that essentially this was a government enterprise competing with private, with the private sector, and then we don't want to do that. So I think there may be some statutory limitations on what they can do. I know Senator Tom Carper has a bill that would give them, as I understand it, more freedom to look into alternative lines of business, but I think it's a tricky area for them, and certainly one that they're sensitive to in regard to arousing any kind of political opposition.
Well, just as anecdotal evidence, I certainly haven't done the kind of research that would be required, but just anecdotally, I think one of the reasons why that's been the case, too, is they haven't been able to be competitive. There was a time where you could go in and buy phone cards when they were very popular. The post office sold them. The price was not anywhere near what you could get. They were much higher than places that you would go. The merchandise that they sell is priced more as an impulse purchase, where I have to have it, and it's not worth the hassle to schlep to another store. So it's not somebody who goes there is not going to buy, I don't think, in enough volume where that can be profitable. And if you're focused on selling one box at a time to one customer rather than 10 boxes, and I don't think anybody thinks the Postal Service should be in the bulk supplies business either, I think that puts them in a situation where the kinds of items that they could potentially sell in addition to selling postage and postal services is rather limited.
I've had one of those Isaac Newton moments, and the solution just hit me: slot machines and post offices.
There you go.
Why didn't I think of that before? All right. Well, listen, again, this is one of those law of unintended consequences things, because they said the old post office, as Benjamin Franklin envisioned it, was stupid, universal service and subsidies and all that. Let's run it like a business. Now that they've been running it like a business for 20 or 30 years, it's not working.
Yeah.
And they're looking at, as Sean said, you've got to save this somehow. Thank you very much, Francis Rose, for being here.
Happy to do it. Sean, great to talk to you.
And we'll be seeing you guys next weekend. Remember, the shows are archived on our homepage, so you can listen anytime. Have a good week and stay safe.
You too, Mike. Thanks.